tonight on Arena. Writer Louise Kennedy on The End of the World is a Cul-de-Sac and The Mauritanians and Minari are among the films up for review. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. First to film reviews on this first Thursday of April. This week sees the release of He Dreams of Giants, a documentary about Terry Gilliam's lifelong obsession with filming Don Quixote. Minari, an autobiographical film from Lee Isaac Chung, in which an Asian American family tries one last shot at the American dream, and the Mauritanian Kevin MacDonald's adaptation of Mahamadou Al-Salehi's Guantanamo Diary. Joining us to look at those films are Roe McDermott and Justin McGregor. And we'll go first to The Mauritanian. It's an adaptation of Mahamadou Salehi's Guantanamo Diary in which he documents his unlawful arrest and torture and his detention for 14 years at Guantanamo Bay. It stars Tahar Rahim as Mahamadou Salehi, Jodie Foster as the lawyer determined to uphold American legal principles, and Benedict Cumberbatch, a prosecution lawyer with a personal interest in seeing Salehi executed. Roe, The Mauritanian sounds like it might be a political thriller or maybe a courtroom drama or a blend of both. What kind of narrative does the director Kevin MacDonald explore here?
Yeah, I think Kevin MacDonald, he's trying to explore a lot of things, and I think it's a very worthy film in its intention, because I think any movie that reminds us of the kind of ongoing civil rights scandal at the heart of the US's extrajudicial detention camp at Guantanamo Bay should be a good thing. And there have been a few excellent films in the past few years about this subject, including The Report 2 years ago, which had Adam Driver investigating the CIA's use of torture after 9/11. But unfortunately, with a lot of these films, they can be incredibly worthy and people can not go to see them. And The Report, while it was excellent and really harrowing and really well researched, made a huge loss at the box office. And I think Kevin MacDonald is just trying to combat that apathy and that the fact that this is such heavy subject matter by playing it quite safe with the formula. So he's taking this tried and tested formula that mixes a bit of legal thriller, a bit of drama, and then puts it on the story of Mahamadou Al-Salehi. And this story is actually based on Salehi's diaries and the work that he was scribbling in Guantanamo Bay and handing off to his lawyers in increments. But the story is instead told from the perspective of these white lawyers. So we have Hollander, who's played by Jodie Foster, and her associate Terry Duncan. And then on the prosecution side, we have Lieutenant Craig, who's played by Benedict Cumberbatch. And it's really told through their perspective. And I feel that's perhaps to appeal to a wider audience and make the formula more safe okay. as dealing with really heavy subject matter.
Well, we have a clip here of the Jodie Foster character. She's Mahamadou's attorney, Nancy Hollander. And she meets the Benedict Cumberbatch character, Stuart Couch, in Guantanamo. And here they spar over a tense beer.
The law says you get open file discovery, and I want you to have discovery. That way, when I beat you, your client will have nothing to hide behind.
You sound very sure of that outcome.
You haven't seen what I've seen. Let me ask you, I understand everyone has a right to a defense, but doesn't it bother you at all working for someone like this?
I'm not just defending him, I'm defending the rule of law.
How very Ignatian of you.
I didn't know that they studied the Jesuits in the Marine Law School.
We like to fully consider a problem before we blow it up.
My turn. Let me ask you. What if you're wrong?
We're not.
What if you are? You built this place. You abandoned all of your principles, all of your laws, and you were wrong.
So Jodie Foster there is Nancy Hollander, and then Stuart Couch is played by Benedict Cumberbatch, and that's the Mauritanian. Justin, would you agree that the film really takes off once Mahamadou writes his diary and suddenly we're back in his life and experiencing his life through Mahamadou himself rather than through the lawyer's perspective?
Oh, it's a really interesting technique, because they have the two lawyers approaching the mystery of did he and didn't he from the two different different sides of defense and prosecution. And it's these letters that begin to take us back through his years of incarceration, his life before he was incarcerated in Guantanamo Bay. And I think that is the most interesting part of the film. I mean, it is very safe with the is he or isn't he kind of approach until it starts to sort of really pick up, especially in the third act, especially near the end, when he finally starts talking about his experience with his torturers, which he suffered through for 70 straight days. And I think that is the strongest part of the film. It's handled really, really well. And these two lawyers kind of from these two sides coming to the same understanding from these radically different perspectives is definitely, I think, the most powerful part of the film. They're only together for two scenes, Jodie Foster and Benedict Cumberbatch, but they're that's sort of the excellent starting one, and they're the very good one sort of nearer the end when they find common ground about Muhammad Dow. But definitely, definitely the letters and the flashbacks and how they're handled, I think, are really, really well done. But it is, as Ro was saying, a very Hollywood approach to this story.
Yes, and Tahar Rahim plays Mohamedou, and he goes through all the experiences of the types of interrogation that we have heard that they've used in Guantanamo, the kind of good top cop, bad cop, then going back to those Abu Ghraib kind of torture scenarios as well.
Yeah, and I think Rahim's performance is really incredible because we do meet him kind of, we meet him in reverse chronology. We meet him as the lawyers meet him and then the movie jumps back. But his performance is so beautifully mapped as he marks the transformation of Salahi. It's this really steady destruction of him being a person kind of gently kissing his mother goodbye when he's picked up by police without any reason, without knowing why, turning into a bit of a jokester at the start, trying to make the best of his captivity and kidding around with the kinder guards. And then we see him as the utterly broken and bruised and bloody and beaten man he ends up being after years of confinement. And he adds just really beautiful touches to his performance. When he meets his lawyers at first, he has a little bit of a smirk and a sway, and it captures this kind of sense of self-preservational cynicism that he has built over his ordeal and his awareness that these two people do not trust him and they do not fully believe him yet, and that awareness. And then you see his performance during the very lengthy and grueling torture sequences that are really gut-wrenching to watch. But it's the subtle details in Rahim's performance that are stunning. And I think Jodie Foster is incredible in this. She kind of brings this intensity and her awareness of how broken the system is. I think Benedict Cumberbatch is slightly wooden in his character, and Shailene Woodley is competent, but for me, Rahim's performance is really stunning.
Well, let's hear from him. Hear Jodie Foster as Nancy Hollander tries to understand what has been happening in detention to her client, Mohamedou Salahi, played by Tahar Rahim.
Why didn't you tell us?
For nothing. Like fantasy. None of that happened.
You signed them.
They made me.
They made you as in they coerced you?
What do you think?
I don't know. You tell me. Did they coerce you? But you gotta tell me what happened, Mohamedou.
You asked me to set fire to this place, but I'm still sitting.
Then write it down. All right, that's what the pages are for. Write it down. You need to tell me the truth. You need to tell me what happened to you. I can't defend you. Do you understand that?
I don't need to tell you nothing. Whatever I say, it doesn't matter. This island, I die here. Outside, my family, my brother, their lives go on. Tara's life goes on. But me here, I'm like a statue. Now you will leave too, and your life will go on.
What the hell do you know about my life? This is it, this is my life. I spend my time in places like this, helping people like you. That's what I do. I don't question my commitment to your case.
The case, the case, the case. You're not committed to me. A person! No. You think I'm guilty? Say it.
Tahar Rahim as Mohamedou Salahi and Jodie Foster as Nancy Hollander there from The Mauritanian. Justin, coming to your stars, overall, what did you think of it and what did you give it out of five?
Well, it is very methodical in places, but it is very, very good. I mean, it's very important for people to really understand, I think, what was going on. And I think they do a great job. Like, the torture scenes could really have been, exploitive and gratuitous. And instead, they're done with this kind of subtlety that's just as harrowing and really quite remarkable. So I thought it's very good. I gave it 4 stars.
And 4 out of 5. And from you, Ro?
I'm going to give it 3.5. I think its intentions are very good. I think Kevin MacDonald is working with a reluctant audience and trying to draw them in. And for me, the only problem was the face of kind of liberal concern is never really met with its counterpart. Everybody in the film's kind of, at the end, a good guy. Even the prosecutor has his own crisis of conscience. And it's not met with any bad guys. There's just official silence and then these end credit explanations about the hideousness of Guantanamo Bay. And Salahi in the film is entitled to his happy ending, but for me, the film glosses over how hideous it really is, and there's too little attention paid to kind of answer unanswered questions and history unresolved. Mm. So a worthy film, but slightly less complicated than the reality. So 3.5 for me.
3.5 and 4 out of 5 for the Mauritanian. Next to Minari, the fifth film from writer-director Lee Isaac Chung. Minari centres on an Asian-American family, father, mother, son and daughter, who have moved from California to Arkansas to cultivate Korean vegetables on a 50-acre farm. The family isn't exactly united, however, and actually expands during the film. Justin, this is Lee Isaac Chung's most autobiographical film to date.
His three features before this, one of them was based on a Korean a folk tale, but was set very much in New York, and another one was set in Rwanda, from two young people from the opposite sides of the conflict there. And his first film went to Cannes, did really, really well. And then his next two films, they did very well. They were well received. But he was actually considering retiring as a filmmaker in 2018. He actually took a job at the University of Utah's Asia campus in Incheon. And he thought, no, I'm going to try one more time. I'm going to write this story that's really, really personal and throw everything he was feeling about who he was, who his family was. And that autobiographical quality, I think, gives this film a real richness to anyone who's ever immigrated or even moved, you know, to cities have felt out of place in the world. He just really tapped into this this amazing subject matter of this family.
So tell us a little bit about the family, Justin.
So the father, Jacob, played by Stephen Yuan, has a dream of finding his place in America, of having land, a big farm, 50 acres is what he wants, and that this is his chance to be a success. His wife, Monica, played by Yeri Han, they were in California for 10 years, and she liked being in the city. She liked the California lifestyle, and they have two kids, one of whom is born in America, David, who has a heart condition, and their daughter, who is Anne, who is kind of relegated very much to the margins at the side, and they're fighting over this: should they be here, should they go back to California? And one of the compromises is that his wife's mother can come from Korea and be, you know, a babysitter and be there to help take care of the kids and be someone for Monica to turn to, and she comes in and is not your typical grandmother. She gambles, she swears, she loves pro wrestling, she teaches the kids to gamble, and she can't even bake cookies. The kids keep saying she's not a real grandmother. So this is the people living in this trailer, you know, on wheels, on this farm, trying to find the American dream, really.
So we listen to a clip. So they're in the trailer on this 50-acre farm that he wants to farm Korean vegetables on for the growing Korean market, but they need water. So here, David, played by Alan Kim, and the father, Stephen Yeun, plays the father, Jacob, are trying to figure out how to find water on the land, and they meet the water diviner, Dowsing Dan, who fails to convince.
$250 for one good clean water well, and $300 for two.
$300?
I tell you what, the fellow before you thought he could save money too. You know what happened to him, huh?
No, we don't need. Let's go back. 멍청한 미국놈들처럼 헛소리를 듣고 있어.
데이빗, 한국 사람은 머리를 써. 오케이?
We use our minds. Yeah, 이리 와봐. 이리 와. 자, 이리. 저기. 비가 오면, where will the water go? High place or low place?
Low place.
그렇지. 오케이, 그럼 low place는 어딨어?
There?
그렇지. 또 어디?
There?
오케이. 그럼 물이 많은 데가 어디야?
There.
Why?
Because trees like water.
아유, 똘똘한 새끼가 있어.
There, that's a clip from Minari, played by David, by played by Alan Kim, and Stephen Yeun, who plays the father Jacob. Ro, so many, many tensions develop within the family because they may be a very united family, but they don't have the same goals.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the beauties at the heart of this film is from one of the first scenes where we see the family pulling up to this mobile home that's on, you know, bricks and wheels. We understand immediately that Monica was not told or is not well informed on that this was going to be their new life in Arkansas. And this has come as a huge shock to her. And that and the issue of money become huge issues in the relationship. But I think even as you can hear from that clip, it's such a delicately told tale, and it's very quietly engaging, and it lets us know about these tensions in very subtle ways. So it's the kids making paper airplanes with the words "don't fight" and throwing them at their parents as their parents are squabbling at night, or it's Monica breaking down in tears when her mother arrives because her mother has brought anchovies and giant bags of chili powder, and it's just this reminder of home and how far Monica is for it. Or it's the microaggressions that the family face down at the local church, which are always presented very with, you know, a smile, but these really insulting racist comments. And it's, there's an authenticity at the heart of this, and there's a gentleness that we never once believed that it's melodramatic, because it all feels so authentic and so real.
Now, the way Ro describes it there, it's gentle, it's, there's tension in it, but it observes every little detail, like the interaction there with Dowsing Dan. There's many more where their job in the factory is checking the sex of chickens. There's all loads of kind of little jokes, Justin. Pace-wise, do you stay with the film? Do you enjoy these characters and their you know, not their slow development, but their progressive development?
Well, that's it. There's a really nice progression, you know, from that initial, you know, response that Ro mentioned of Monica seeing the, you know, the trailer on wheels that's going to be their new home. And it just kind of builds, but it does unfold at this very, very nice pace. But while that's, you know, while that may be happening kind of in the screen time, the tension that's underneath what's going on are building and building and building. So the fights have this real depth and subtext to them, because it builds on all the things that have gone before between the husband and wife. And it is that kind of way it progresses and builds while it's unfolding at this kind of very naturalistic pace that I think still makes it a very, very dramatic film that, yeah, does avoid going into melodrama. I mean, it's a bit maybe melodramatic at the end, you know, what happens where the metaphor becomes the literal, as it were. But other than that, it is that, you know, that movement towards, you know, a decision they make about, you know, about separating or not separating, that is just so authentic and heartbreaking in the quiet way it's actually reached between the two parents.
Ro, we should make the point that the film is mainly in Korean. It's just that their interaction with the American community is often is mainly in English, but that's not very often within the film. It's mainly within the family itself. So the performances are, like, it really hangs on these strong performances, doesn't it?
Yeah, and the performances are beautiful. I think Stephen Yeun is possibly the most well-known cast member, and he was on The Walking Dead. And he, as Jacob, is this man who is, I think what's so telling about the first scene when they see the mobile trailer, but also they see the land around it, is the difference in reactions. Whereas Monica is looking at this thing, thinking, I'm going to be trapped in rural America. Jacob really sees this as America, as the land of opportunity. And it is that dichotomy, that idea of America can be both, particularly for immigrant families, that both of the actors capture so well. Alan S. Kim as David is just so sweet and mischievous, and Yoo Jung-yeon as Soonja, the grandmother, is also just so mischievous and unconventional, and their relationship is really lovely to see on screen.
So Ro, stars out of 5?
I think I'm going to give it a 4. I think the drama is lovely. The characterization is lovely. I think the presentation and the cinematography is quite impersonal and a bit generic. And there isn't a sense of place. It's kind of very approximate. The locations play out like sets. And also the movie is largely centered on David, the young boy's experience, but it misses that element of kind of curiosity or wonder or fantasy or terror. So there's such a beautiful, slow, heartfelt pull to Minari, but I wish the script trusted that the universal emotion would still shine through specifics and just lent into that
okay.
a little bit more.
But 4 really out of 5 from you. And for you, Justin?
Yeah, I did feel those specifics were there, and that it was the whole family coming of age rather than just David. And to me, that was what was so fascinating. Yeah, great, great acting. I gave it 4.5 out of 5. Lovely film.
So 4.5 and 4 out of 5 for Minari. And our final film this evening is He Dreams of Giants, the second documentary made about Terry Gilliam and his lifelong obsession over filming his version of Don Quixote. The film is directed by Keith Fulton and Louis Pepe, and while he may not be directly tipping at windmills, we do see Gilliam in the full kind of agony of creative torture and frustration over a film project which has brought him to the brink many times. So, Justin, you have seen the final product of his, you have seen his film that was finally made last year, I think, Don Quixote, and then you've also seen this documentary. Put Terry Gilliam and his idiosyncratic vision in context, maybe, first of all.
Well, it's funny because I've been basically watching this film for 19 years. If you saw Lost in La Mancha in 2002, which was his first major try of trying to make the film that just went more pear-shaped than could even be imagined, even down to the little detail of the stunt horse hating Johnny Depp that had to ride it at the time. And then, yeah, finally gets the money back again, gets the script back from the lawyers and the banks that, you know, seize them after the first film fails. And he makes The Man Who Killed Don Quixote. And then this is like, it's really like a trilogy. This is the film that goes into not only the making of The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, but I think really goes into Terry Gilliam, and not just Terry Gilliam, but the aging process and the aging of Terry Gilliam. I mean, it shows his first interviews from Monty Python and his kind of idiosyncrasies then and his kind of mad genius. It shows him on the set of, you know, The Holy Grail, admitting that he doesn't know how to direct and he's learning on the job. And then we have this older Terry Gilliam finally realizing his dream and alternating between rage at things not going the way he wants it and a childlike giddiness, you know, giggling as he's watching the film being made at the same time. And it's an amazing journey that they then capture, you know, in this documentary of not only the making of the film, but really a man coming to the end of his own dream.
And Ro, Justin touched on the various casts he went through in his very long search to put Don Quixote on the screen. Could you rehearse some of those for us?
Yeah, so this has been happening for 30 years and the production was plagued by weather issues, by production issues, by temperamental horses. There was Johnny Depp attached, there was Gene Roquefort, there was Ewan McGregor. There were all these different cast members who kept on weaving in and out of this production and finally settled on Adam Driver and Jonathan Pryce in the roles that once fell to Johnny Depp and John Roquefort. But there's an incredible moment on the filming of The Man Who Killed Don Quixote where a crew member who has been with Gilliam through every iteration of this production, and he toasts the director and their 7th day of filming, because that's the furthest they've ever gotten. And it is just remarkable to think of all the obstacles this film has faced. But it's also interesting to note the obstacles that this film doesn't address, because there was like a litigious producer and Amazon Studio decision not to release its own production. And they could have gone much further into that. But instead, as Justin said, they really focus on Gilliam's often hubristic determination and whether that determination is sanity or madness, and much in a very Don Quixote way, is it the desire to see the film as it is or as it should be?
Well, let's listen. Go on, Rose.
Oh, I just think it's interesting that the production, when it's finally underway, isn't actually that bad, but the toil and the turmoil and almost the trauma really stays with Gilliam. So he's quite tormented even when production is going well, which is interesting.
Let's listen to a clip from the documentary. Here, Terry Gilliam speaks about what the creative impulse means to him. He speaks with passion here, including strong language.
Why does anybody create? Because we can. Because we don't have a choice. It's hard. Life is hard. Art is hard. And the idea that it should be fun? Who the fuck invented that story?
So there's Terry Gilliam in He Dreams of Giants. Ro, I think you also said that there is a parallel. Is Gilliam Quixote, are there parallels in the stories? Does that work as an analogy?
I think Fulton and Pepe, the directors, they really do lean into this analogy of Gilliam being Quixote, the idea of pursuit against all of the odds. It's not the most original observation, and I think they could have gone deeper. I think there are some things that are missing. There, Gilliam has health issues during the production, and it's very casually mentioned, along with a glimpse of a catheter and a bag of blood draining. And there are some comments from crew members who stuck with Gilliam throughout the years, as I mentioned. But there's no interviews with, for example, Adam Driver or Jonathan Pryce, who are the new stars. And we don't really get a sense of other people's experience of Gilliam's creative drive. I think there are some interesting things, like there's an unseen interviewer, as we heard in that clip, who seems to act as Gilliam's psyche, asking, is the film better left in your head? And we see Gilliam tormented and kind of contemplating these questions and giving his responses. But I think they could have pushed the metaphor further and really dove deeper into Gilliam's psyche, or panned out a little bit and looked at creative process generally. And I think the film tries to occupy a liminal space between being about creativity generally and being about Gilliam, and never fully commits to both, which I found slightly frustrating.
Well, as you can imagine, any thought you had was mirrored by another Gilliam quote. So here, let's hear him talking about the enduring connection to Cervantes' text.
Quixote struck me more powerfully when I reached, middle age, because that's what I thought Quixote was very much about. It's like a last hurrah. The tale of this old man whose body was failing, who at the same time, his spirit and willpower was thriving, flourishing.
He's an older man. He has one last chance to make the world as interesting as he dreams it to be.
Now, you, Justin, are the expert here. You've seen all the two documentaries and the film itself. But it's interesting. It's a man aging, a creative man, but it is the trials of fighting against the Grim Reaper and aging, isn't it?
Oh, no, very much so. I mean, there's a scene where he kind of wanders off into the desert, and he starts talking about where, the young man I was would have embraced this and had so much energy. And, he's dead. He's gone, that young man. And he talks another time about being, how did he become this curmudgeon? That there was a time he was so optimistic about things. And really, I think it goes into that side of Gilliam, but almost more as like an obituary for, the project, and maybe in some ways for him. Like he wonders when the dream is over, when you've realized your dream, what's on the other side? And he says, a void. And, and he's surrounded by, people like Nicola Pecorini, his DOP, who's been with him for these 20 years. And he talks about his own aging, too. So this sense that they're all coming to the end of the road, just as Quixote was, I think is done very well. Not in the sense of just a parallel, but that, that creative force that he was is starting to fade and diminish. Mm-hmm. And he wonders, is this my last film?
Now, Stars Out of Five from you, Justin.
Oh, the film is, of course, Quixotic. so I'm going to give it the same I gave The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, which was 4.5. I think it's great for this trilogy to kind of come to an end. But I do recommend seeing all three films.
You want us all to suffer like you did. And what about you, Ro, out of five?
I'm going to do the same. I'm also going to give what I gave The Man Who Didn't Kill Don Quixote, which was 3.5. And I think if the film had introduced Gilliam slightly more for audiences who aren't already obsessed with him, it would have had a broader audience. Or if it had dove in a little bit deeper, I think it would have been more satisfying for Gilliam's fans. So knocking a few points off for that. But I, as Justin said, a really interesting examination of creativity and age. And okay. I just wish it had committed to one or the other slightly more.
So 4.5 out of 5 and 3.5 out of 5 for He Dreams of Giants. And Minari and The Mauritanian are all available on digital release. Justin McGregor and Ro McDermott, thank you. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. The Irish short story is in rude good health. That's if the last week on Arena is anything to go by. Jen Carson and John Patrick McHugh have both come on the show to tell us about their new books, The Last Resort and Pure Gold. Tonight, it's the turn of Louise Kennedy. With her debut collection, The End of the World is a Cul-de-Sac, which is published today. Louise has won awards for her stories and been shortlisted twice for the prestigious Sunday Times Audible Short Story Prize since beginning to write in only 2014. You may have heard her on Arena in January when she came on to talk about the writer Nora Holt. I'm delighted to say that Louise Kennedy joins me now from Sligo. Congratulations on The End of the World is a Cul-de-Sac, Louise. And it's nice to see that the story we spoke to you about in the winter papers in Bullock also makes an appearance in the collection.
Thank you very much for having me, Kay. So In Bullock is in the collection as well. Yeah, that's right. Along with 14 other stories.
Indeed. So the title story is about a woman called Sarah, the former wife of a Celtic Tiger property developer, who finds herself now living on her own, virtually penniless, in the deserted house. Can you tell us a little bit about Sarah and her fall from grace? And I know you'll read from the story shortly.
Yeah, so the title story, The End of the World is a Cul-de-Sac, is about a woman who lives in a kind of a, in my head, it's like a James Bond kind of Bond villain's mansion overlooking a ghost estate, a sort of little cul-de-sac of semi-detached houses. And she's been abandoned by her developer husband a kind of dwindling bundle of money in a kind of grubby envelope, and is kind of slowly going around the bend. And then she meets a man and has to compromise herself, I guess. So that's what it's about.
Okay, so you're going to read from the very beginning of the story.
The dereliction was almost beautiful. The houses dark against the mauve dawn, pools of buff coloured water glinting briefly as a passing car took the last bend before town. Number 7 was starting to look like the other units, the lawn stringy with brown weeds. The footpath petered out and Sarah landed hard in a puddle, picking her way over broken masonry and loops of cable until she reached the end of the cul-de-sac. The noise was coming from the show house. It looked even worse inside than out. Clots of dung littered the travertine floor. All the doors had been taken, including the front one, which only seemed to emphasise how small the rooms were. The donkey was in the living room by the cavity in the chimney breast where the granite fireplace had been. It was plump and skittish, pastilles of dried sleep at the corners of its eyes. Sarah whispered to it, cajoled, pleaded. She tried shooing it, spreading her arms to drive it out of the hallway. It pawed and snattered and a flume of shit hit the wall behind it. She would have to go and get her neighbour.
That's The End of the World is a Cul-de-Sac. The title, the beginning of the titled story from Louise Kennedy. That theme of the woman either living trapped or managing to carve their own life within the influence of a present or an absent man runs through a lot of the collection, doesn't it?
I guess it does. I mean, that definitely, it wasn't an intention, but I can see now when I read them that that's definitely a theme, all right, yeah.
Yeah, because there's trays in Beyond Carthage, for example, and she's going on the on this trip with her friend, but she's really kind of worried and trying to sort out the problems in her own marriage while she's away.
Or escape them, I guess, so that story is set, it's set on in like a kind of ghastly resort in Tunisia in the rain in March. I mean, I guess it's just about a woman sort of reckoning with the kind of collapse of her marriage.
In Silhouette is the name of, I think, is it the second or third story?
Yeah, it's the second story.
Yeah, and it's pretty overtly about the past and the troubles. Mm-hmm. Could you introduce us to the woman at the centre of that story? She hints about a man she once saw in Silhouette in a bar.
Yeah, so that story, I mean, I suppose that I come from the north originally. It's not really very detectable from my accent anymore, but I come from the north originally. And I suppose, you know, one of the big sort of legacy issues of the Troubles, you know, for some people would be the idea of the disappeared. And I just remember being in my car when I was driving. I did an MA in Queens. And when I was in my car one day, I heard on the radio that a search had begun for one of the missing people. And I just remember wondering what it would be like to know what had happened, because somebody must know something, and to not come forward. So I guess that's where the story came from. So it opens with a teenage girl in the 70s getting dressed up to go out to, you know, walk up the road from the farm she lives on to the local pub. And this man, a kind of stranger, walks into a bar, which is probably a bit of a cliche, but yeah, this man comes into the bar who kind of notices her, and I guess it's just about how that image of him in Silhouette stays with her.
Yeah, and you're going to read a section from In Silhouette as well.
So this is from the story. Actually, I guess it takes place really over about 40 years, which is probably like breaking a very fundamental rule of short story writing. So this is maybe about 3 years later in 1981, 3 or 4 years later, when this, you know, this teenage girl is now, you know, a young woman, and she is living in London, and she's gone for a drink with the security man from the department store that she works in. Sean finishes his pint in one gulp and crosses the yeasty floral carpet to the gents. The woman at the next table is leaning into her man, pointing at the floor where you've put your white patent leather handbag. You pick it up, rooted in it, fingers moving over the greasy leather. Thaddy's wing is in lockdown and your mother hasn't seen him for months. You try to imagine your brother in a blanket, his hair matted with shite, but you can't picture him. You take out a lipstick and drag it slowly across your mouth, pressing your lips together when you're done. Then you use it to write four big letters across the side of your bag. Sean appears, hooking at the waistband of his trousers. There's a light on the wall above his head and his face is grey and shiny. He takes quick, light steps to the payphone and lifts the receiver, presumably to ring the woman who made his sandwich. You turn your handbag so the couple at the next table can read it. You've written "bomb" in shade 1981, English rose.
Louise Kennedy reading from In Silhouette, from The End of the World is a Cul-de-Sac. There is that sense of the truth will out, both in Silhouette and in other stories. The things hidden in the past, I think Sparing the Heather is another. The things buried and, well, not forgotten, but thought to be hopefully forgotten, will come to the surface.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, I don't know if that's just... I don't know if that's just about me being older or something. Like, I didn't start to write until I was 47, and it's maybe just about like, I really think that people carry things all of their lives, and I suppose, you know, the short stories are you know, I mean, I guess it's quite an intense kind of dramatic effect very often that you're trying to create, and maybe some of the scenarios are not. You know, there. I mean, I guess in some ways they're not sort of everyday scenarios, but I just think that, you know, I like that idea of people sort of carrying things that they can't really escape.
Now, we've mentioned that you didn't start writing until 2014 mm-hmm. and that you had a whole other career before that.
Yeah.
So what did you do and how did you come to write at that particular point?
Well, when I left school, I did a social science degree and thought that I might end up being a social worker, but that didn't happen. And I went to work in London and I had a ghastly job in an American merchant bank in the city where I was literally putting microfiche in alphabetical order 40 hours a week for about a year for terrible money. And so I didn't stay very long in London and I came home and borrowed money and did a cordon bleu course. So I suppose I was pretty much cooking and running restaurants for nearly 30 years, about 28 years or something. And in 2014, I was asked to join a writing group by a friend. And like, I'm not the sort of person who joins things. So I think I laughed at first and refused. And I mean, she kept at me for a little while. And I must have had some kind of curiosity because I went along and agreed to try and write a short story. Worked on it for about 5 weeks. But I think that really from probably by the time I got to the end of the first paragraph, I didn't really want to do anything else. So, so I've just been trying to write ever since.
Now, after writing this wonderful collection, can you give us what is some insight into the short story? Not how to do it, but mm-hmm. maybe, you know, what have you found about doing them in your own intense writing of them?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I guess I started off trying to write short stories. So that's all I was doing for about, I don't know, since, you know, probably for about 5 years. And and then 2 years ago, I wasn't well and I was off work, but I wasn't so sick that I couldn't write. So I forced myself to get a draft of a novel down. And it was an idea that I'd been exploring, beforehand. But I forced myself to get a draft of a novel down. And I think it may be, it's best, you know, I can only talk about it in comparison with writing a novel. I think there's something really... I think short stories are much more kind of fragile or delicate things or something. So I think that it's maybe about trying to set a tone at the very start and trying to maintain that, to create some sort of effect. I think that, when they're done properly and all of the, all of this kind of tat is taken away with editing, I think they can be really taut and affecting. So yeah, I think I love them. I think they're tremendous form.
And you have a novel coming out, When I Moved to the Sky. So
yeah.
Is that novel that you were working on, or is this a new novel?
No, that's the novel that I was working on. So so that is my editor and myself are going to be working at Bloomsbury. Alexis are going to be working on edits on the novel for I guess the next few months, and then it'll go to copy edits and stuff. So I think we're hoping for next year.
Very good. Well, we look forward to that. But in the meantime, everybody can read The End of the World is a Cul-de-Sac. It's published by Bloomsbury. Louise Kennedy appears at the West Cork Literary Festival event on the 6th of April, along with Jen Carson, Lucy Colwell and Adrian Duncan and John Patrick McHugh. Further details from westcorkmusic.ie. You're listening to Arena. Emmaji is the musical moniker of Polish composer, arranger and producer Marcin Cieszyn, whose debut album has just been released. Arriving in Ireland 10 years ago, Marcin was also one of the founders of the hugely prolific Diffusion Lab, a production house that has brought us artists such as Jafaris, Nilo, Sule and Mango and Mathman, to name just a few. We'll talk to Emmaji or Marcin in a few moments after Diffusion about Diffusion Lab. But let's start with his debut album, which is entitled My Journeys. Here's a track, one that features singer Hummingbird. This is Larimar. That was Emmaji featuring Hummingbird, and it's the lead single from his new album. The album is called My Journeys, and that song was Larimar. Imogi, you're very welcome. I talked about Hummingbird there. They're a duo. Tell us about that song and the duo Hummingbird.
How you doing? Yeah, this song is about the darkness and light, basically. You know, something like you don't know your light until you know your darkness. So, like, you need to know yourself in the way that, okay, you're not a great person, you're not too amazing, you know, you're basically human being, you know, with your flaws and all that, you know. And, you know, you need to know this to kind of realize how good you are as well, you know. And yes, coming back to Hummingbird, I've approached them after I've composed that on the piano. I was like, listen, can you make this song better? Can we make something together, you know? And they were like, yeah, cool, let's try it. You know, we sat down in the studio, and took us a day to just compose what we have there, you know, and record and finish.
Now, you've also, Imogi, said that you'd hope that this album would help people feel closer to nature and to get involved in their communities and to remind listeners to look after their mental health.
Yes, thank you for saying that. That would be amazing.
Is that a passion of yours?
It's one of my passions, I guess, you know. I mean, we live in a world where we need to connect, where we need to have some circle around us, you know. We need to have a friend, you know. And I feel we need to have a connection to nature. And I hope my music is going to help that, you know, take it on the jogs, take it when you meditate, you know, or even take it on your walks, you know. That's what I've done with other music. When I jogged, when I was going to my morning walks, I just, you know, put on the headphones and throw some nice music, basically. So I was like, okay, I could do that too. I could do that kind of thing to embrace that, you know, to make people listening to this sort of music, if they want to, obviously.
What definition would you put on your music, or what are the range of influences that you look at when you're composing?
I think one of the biggest influences was Peter Sandberg, a Swedish producer, composer. I think basically I kind of listened to a lot of cinematic music, as soundtracks, you know, typical or less typical film scores. And that was quite a big inspiration, a part of actual like nature and walks. Because yes, I just love this kind of sound, and it feels really ambitious to me to do it. And I wanted to try. I actually wanted to try to do something like, okay, what did I not really try before? And what, well, I kind of tried, but I really failed on at, you know. And that was film scoring, basically. So I was like, okay, let me give it another go. And also my life experience has just, you know, kind of thrown me into that area.
Okay, so we can all be in our own movie, walking in nature, listening to that music. Yeah. Fantastic. Can we move on to your work with Diffusion Lab? I name some of the people there, Mango and Mathman, Jafaris, Nilo, Sule. What a wonderful stable you have. How did you get those talents together?
Well, you know, talent comes in, I guess. What happened was around 2015, Chris and Ivan met. And then at the same time, I came to Ireland for the second time, basically. There's a bigger story behind that. But yeah, and we kind of sat down together. Diffusion Lab was nearly set up, and we were like, okay, maybe we could try to do this together. And, you know, the talent was already asking through the friends, like, do you know any producers maybe that kind of do this sort of music, like rap or R&B? And you know, they were told by their friends that, yeah, we do it. So, and they come, they came, you know, and they stayed.
Right. Yeah. And do you have defined roles working with those artists like Jafaris and Nilo and Sule?
You know, it's kind of evolving all the time. Like at the start, it was a bit of everything by everyone. Like, you know, it's a small company and all that. So, like, everybody has to do everything that we can. But nowadays, it's more defined as, you know, Ivan is the most of the business person involved in artist management and company management. Chris is most of a producer, and I'm doing pretty much all engineering and mixing. That's kind of my choice as well, because I feel this is the most skills in of mine, basically.
Well, let's listen to another piece of music. This one is called Unspoken, and it features a singer called Sandra Maria. Can you tell us a little bit about her and the song?
Sandra is actually my lovely girlfriend. Hi, Sandra, if you listen to this.
Hello, Sandra.
Basically, that song is about experience in our relationship, basically. So we had a really, really beautiful emotional experience in the forest. And a couple days later, we sat down and just wrote that song together. And we were still pretty emotional and pretty vulnerable.
That's Unspoken, and that was Sandra Maria. We know it's Imogee's girlfriend and co-singer there in the Irish-produced Polish composer Marcin Ciszon, and his name is Imogee, and the album is called My Journey. That's all for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Paula Shields. Damien Chanels was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's show was produced by Ola McGowan.